You're listening to the best music in the New River Valley. It's WUBT-FM 90.7, Blacksburg, Christiansburg, Radford.
Independent music,
24/7.
It's WUBT-FM.
Obscurious, our, I guess, semi-weekly, semi-regular talk show.
Semi-regular.
Yeah, my name is Connor Kadra.
My name is Christopher Ricky.
And I'm going to pass it to Chris to introduce our concept.
Sure. So the premise of our show is that we use random Wikipedia articles to generate topics for discussion, and we'll update you on some of last week's topics. So Connor, you received the Decay of Fiction, correct?
I did. All right, so just as a quick kind of catch-up. Yeah, so I stumbled upon this experimental art film called The Decay of Fiction by this somewhat old, like obscure
experimental
filmmaker, yeah, named Pat O'Neill. And I emailed him, and I thought it was like his manager maybe, and I was like, yo, can I buy this movie, The Decay of Fiction, because I couldn't find it anywhere on the internet. And Pat himself responded like 3 hours later, and he's like, oh, I'll send you a copy in the mail. So I did get a copy. It isn't like an official copy, you know, like it's not like printed and everything, but it is like a copy, has his handwriting on it. I have it. So we didn't get a chance to watch it for this week, but we will watch it for our next episode.
Give a contrasting viewpoints and review on the film.
We'll probably watch it separately and then come to our own conclusions. So,
and a minor correction for last week's show. I had a Easter on the brain. The small stem coming out of the middle of a flower is not a stigmata, it's a stigma. So I don't really think anyone really caught that, though.
No, yeah, that's like a religious thing, right?
Like the wounds of Jesus when he was like nailed on the cross.
Right. All right. Do you want to, for people who have not listened before, do you want to like t- told them the idea behind the show.
Oh, we already went over that, Connor.
Oh, I guess we did. All right. all right. So should we get started on our topics, I figure?
Yeah, sure. So your topic was wordless novels, right?
Yeah. So it's a particular wordless novel called Vertigo, and it was published by Lynd Ward. All right. So I'll give you some like general background about the concept of wordless novel. Do you know what that is?
I have no idea, but I'm assuming it's like a comic book.
It's similar to a comic book. Basically, what it is it's kind of a predecessor to a comic book. So these kind of things were very common, or not very common, but they were, you know, the equivalent of comic books, graphic novels in the early 20th century. And the main medium that was used was wood cutting. Are you familiar with the medium of wood cutting?
Yeah, you just kind of stencil in some art into wood, and then sometimes they put ink over it to like bring out certain contrasts in the woodcuts.
Right.
I know, who is it, William Blake? He has a very famous woodcut called The Ancient of Days.
Right, correct.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
So.
That was always, you know, woodcutting in general has been a very popular form of artwork for, you know, centuries. I mean, in Japan especially, it's very well known for it. And so what this does is kind of like a more modernist take on the idea of woodcutting, and it kind of compiles an entire story based around it. And it's basically, so there's no dialogue in a wordless novel. It's all just these kind of very striking woodcut images. And typically it was kind
there's
of
there's no used, plot or anything?
Well, there is a plot, but it's told in images. So it's kind of like a children's picture book almost.
Oh, okay.
But it's more sophisticated because it's meant for adults. And yeah, so basically it was very common in the 20s and 30s, and especially it had its origin in the German Expressionist movement. And it oftentimes was like very kind of focused around like labor rights and kind of, you know, helping the little man. And a big thing that happened
very left-leaning artists kind of thing.
Yeah, it was pretty left-leaning. And but one thing that makes that interesting is that it originated in Germany, and then as soon as the Nazis
after World War One.
Yeah, after World War One in Weimar Germany, and then after, you know, Hitler and the Nazis took power, it was kind of seen as like degenerate art, and so they kind of suppressed it because it was, you know, socialist. So in mind. All right. So in terms of this particular novel, it's called Vertigo. Yeah, it's published by this American artist named Lynd Ward, who's probably like the most famous American wordless novel writer artist. I don't know how exactly you define
it. Not exactly in the scene, so it's
you're right.
The most famous one to me.
Right, right, and to me too as well. I never even knew this was a thing. But basically, what this is about is that, so it's a wordless novel, you know, it uses sequences of captionless pictures to tell a story, which uses woodcuts. And this specifically, let me see. The visuals are really fascinating because, so it's entirely black and white, it's entirely woodcut, and the use of shadows is really fascinating. I would highly recommend looking it up. It's kind of like considered the kind of pinnacle of, or at least American, wordless novels. And
well, what's the difference between the countries like America versus Germany and the wordless novels?
I would say that from what I've studied, like, I would say the American style is a little more bombastic, you know, and I think especially with Vertigo, it has, like, very striking imagery, and it really reminded me of, are you familiar with, like, the futurist art style of the early 20th century?
I mean, like, in, like, the 1950s, they had, like, those flying cars everywhere?
Kind of. That's kind of, like, a newer wave of it, but the original futurism was, like, 1910s, 1920s, kind of, like, immediately post-World War One, and it was very, it was, like, a world of tomorrow, but through a kind of earlier lens, and it usually had, like, these very, like, sharp edges and kind of really intense imagery, and, yeah, and it also reminded me of, you're familiar with, like, Soviet propaganda, like...
Oh, yeah, I get, like, the red, black, white.
Yeah,
yeah.
The simple colors, and
it's
they always
very
have, like,
sharp,
the...
font letters.
Exactly, and, like, they have, like, very sharp jaws and everything. Like,
right.
It's all very, like, geometric. And, yeah, so that's, like, I mean, obviously the visuals are the main kind of popping out kind of idea here, but the plot is fascinating, too. So it takes place between 1939 and 1935 in America, and, of course, it's during the Depression, and, especially like wordless novels were very linked with the Depression because of the role of kind of people upset with like the current economic situation and the role
right.
of, you know, unions and stuff. And it's broken into three parts and follows a young woman, a young man, an elderly man. And they all kind of, it's specifically broken into three parts, but...
Are they occurring, the plot lines occurring like concurrently or is
yeah.
it sequential?
It's kind of like a, you know, a Tarantino film. It's like non-linear. So it's like they do kind of overlap, but you read them at different points in time. And specifically, this guy, Lynd Ward, he said that, like, you don't have to read it cover to cover. You can kind of approach wherever you want because there's going to be points where...
You can start at any point in the
yeah,
book.
Because, you know, I mean, it's not even...
Or wordless novel, excuse me.
Oh, right, wordless novel in the piece. Because, you know, these three stories intersect, and it's like you don't have to... And there aren't page numbers even, and there aren't even words. So you kind of have to figure out from context what exactly is going on. And basically what it follows is, let me see here. So they all kind of follow different characters. And so in terms of this girl, it's kind of like a girl who has a very optimistic future, gets engaged to like a handsome young man. But then like the Great Depression kind of splits them. And then like the elderly guy is like kind of, it's a critique of like the old, like, you know, like the fat cat and like the super wealthy who kind of ignores what's going on.
The bankers.
Yeah, the bankers basically. And then there's the boy, the young man, who's kind of a guy who like is fed up with his small town life and heads off on his own. And yeah, I just find this really fascinating because I never known that this was a art form at all. And generally, it's kind of thought of as a precursor to
graphic novels,
and
comic books.
Comic books to a degree, but I think with comic books, there's kind of like that pulpy sense. Do you know what I mean? Like pulp
like
fiction,
like more. It's not as like high level,
no.
And like the story isn't as complicated.
I guess. With graphic novels, you know, like Watchmen or Mouse, it's supposed to be more of like a.
Yeah, I love Watchmen.
Yeah, Watchmen's great, man. It's a classic. And like anything like that, Alan Moore, you know, it's like supposed to be, I guess, a more
well-developed story.
Yeah, complex storyline. And so this is kind of the case here. And in terms of the themes, I mean, obviously it's, you know, critical of capitalism during the Great Depression and very union supportive. And then in terms of legacy, like, it was fascinating because this is kind of, since it was so focused in Germany, as soon as the Nazis came to power and they kind of suppressed this whole art form, it entirely, like, disappeared. And so he was like the only American, or really the only artist in the world, like making these books after 1932. This came out in 1937. It was his last one, but still, like he made a couple when nobody else was making
them.
Did
he give it up, or did he die, and that's why it was his last one?
He gave it up. I think just, you know, the world is changing, and like they didn't really have room for it anymore.
Or he didn't just have any interest in it anymore.
I mean, I guess he was a pretty well accomplished and varied guy in his career, and yeah. So let me see. Yeah, as I said, like there's no page numbers, there's like no clear, like specific kind of timeline to what's going on. And also something that's interesting in a very literal sense is that there's no borders to the pages. So the artwork, the woodcuts go all the way to the very end, kind of bleed into each other. So
like
it's very
how in like a comic book there's like the grid lines separating each panel. But I guess since every page is its own art piece, then there's no need for that border.
Exactly, yeah. It's all individual art pieces, and there isn't, like, you know, yeah, as you said, it's not broken up into, like, quarters or, like, nine different panels. It's all just, like, one big artwork. And so it's fascinating because he created over, it says, over 230 wood engravings. So it took years to make just for, like, this really intense visual experience. And, I mean, each individual piece is really, like, its own work of art.
Can you, like, describe a scene from the book? Vertigo or wordless novel?
Yeah. So there's this one here. I can show you. I'll zoom in on it. And the description specifically says, a rainstorm spoils a young couple's carefree trip to an amusement park in 1929, foreshadowing the Great Depression to come. And so I'm showing it to Chris here, but you can look this up on the Wikipedia page. The idea is that you kind of have this really hectic scene where it's supposed to be a roller coaster.
Yeah, there's a lot of elements going on.
It's extremely maximalistic, yeah. And the lighting is really fascinating. It's the shadow work. And as you can see, like, there's really sharp lines interspersed with kind of, like, these more fantastical elements. And I guess the center of attention is really drawn to the star here, so.
Yeah, and I can see how, like, I was having a hard time imagining, like, how you could convey, like, a whole story through the picture.
Yeah.
Or just through a series of pictures. But the picture is so intricate that there's so much detail you can pick up from that. It really adds, like, to the setting, and, like, you can tell, like, how the characters are feeling.
Yeah, I mean, you
or what's going to happen.
Yeah, for sure, because, I mean, you could spend, like, you know, 5 or 10 minutes just studying one of these pages. So, like, you know, it's going to take as long as a normal book to read to take it all in. And so, and yeah, like, as you can see, like, an interesting kind of contrast is you'll have, like, these, like, super hectic scenes, and then I'll look up, like, another picture where
is it
like,
just like a single subject, like almost
exactly.
Like a still life where there is all focus on like one object in the painting or picture or
yeah cut? It'll go from kind of an outdoor scene that's super hectic and like contrast straight to like just a single image in a dark room.
So what me and Connor are looking at right now is a violinist, and it's totally centered on the violin and violinist. Nothing else is in the picture.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, it's trying to discuss the conflict between kind of the individual and the collective during the Great Depression. And, yeah, so I don't know. I just found that really fascinating. I'll
it
definitely,
looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's on Amazon, so I was thinking about getting it and checking it out. Yeah, so
Add it to our obscure art collection.
Yeah,
with the decay of fiction
that we're compiling of experimental art. All right, so I'm going to pass it over to Chris now. What is your prepared topic for today?
Yeah, so my topic isn't an art topic. It's talking about a shark attack that occurred in Egypt in 2010. So keep in mind that we have a 1 in 6 million chance of generating one of these Wikipedia articles.
Right.
So they're going to be, like, really out there. So it was called the 2010 Sharm el-Sheikh shark attacks. Sharm el-Sheikh is a resort town located on the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula. If you guys don't know where that is, it's kind of along the Red Sea, and it has a lot of tourist attractions. So there's reefs, there's national parks, very calm beaches, very warm. It's also
a common tourist spot?
What?
Would you say it's a common tourist spot?
For Russians. So right, I'll get into that a little later. So it's also a religious pilgrimage site because now Sinai is very close.
Right.
Mount Sinai is where, like, Moses held, like, the Ten Commandments up, so it's a very important pilgrimage site in Judaism and Christianity. And they suspect that the shark attacks were caused by an oceanic white-tip shark. And so a lot of people focus on, like, the great white shark as, like, you know, the most dangerous shark.
Like the Shark Week-esque.
Like, yeah. Like,
the main
because
irrational
it's
fears.
The it's one of the largest predatory ones.
Yeah.
And it was in Jaws.
Right.
But it's actually the oceanic white tip shark is the one that has caused the most human deaths, because unlike other sharks that are more like solitary, oceanic white tip sharks, they end up in feeding frenzies. So there's this ship called the U.S. Indianapolis in World War II. Like, I think like 300 sailors died, like, and a lot of them were to oceanic white tip shark attacks.
Yeah. Was that referenced in the movie Jaws when he gives that speech?
I think,
like,
so.
Yeah,
yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. So anyway, onto this specific shark attack itself,
right,
or a series of shark attacks. So in one day, 4 people were attacked off the beach. Most of them were Russian tourists, a 70-year-old woman, a 54-year-old man,
oh, wow,
and a 46-year-old man. And I think one person lost her right hand and her leg.
Oh.
And, like, another person, like, lost their entire arm. So it's pretty vicious.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, because of, like, the feeding frenzies of the oceanic white tip sharks, like, that's how, like, so many people, like, were attacked at the same exact time.
It's
wasn't, like, one shark.
Right. It's like a social phenomenon, I guess, as soon as it, like, it's kind of like a
evolutionary
domino effect.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
So, like, that's why people were so confused. Like, how could one shark attack so many people at once and be so aggressive? So, obviously, all the tourists in Sharm el-Sheikh were traumatized.
Right.
And no one wanted to go on the beach anymore. And, like, so traumatized, like, a local barman said that, like, no one would even go on, like, the sunbathe on the beach because they were that,
oh, wow,
scared. So, the Egyptian officials in Sharm el-Sheikh, they closed down the beaches and suspended all water sports. Local fishermen were out, like, looking for the shark as, like, a reward. They caught a mako shark.
Hmm.
It was just a different species. Like, they were afraid that the local conservationists there were afraid that it was going to spur on, like, an aggressive shark hunt, even though it was only, like, a handful of sharks.
Right, right.
Of a certain species. And so this brought down the tourist industry in the town, and it was highly reliant upon it. And so they eventually opened it back up. And then as soon as they opened it back up, there was another shark attack against a scuba diver. So then that brought down, like, even the tourism industry even more. And so they paid, I think, to each of the victims $50,000. So what's a little more interesting is how what the causes of the shark attack were. And they have, like, a couple different theories. So the first theory is that it was during, like, the Islamic feast celebration, Eid, E-I-D,
right,
correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were dumping sheep carcasses, like, off the coastline. So they think all the sharks came into the area to feed off of those carcasses.
Right.
And then they moved on to the closer to the beaches.
It's an unfortunate coincidence, I guess.
And then, it's multifaceted, though, so it just wasn't, like, one issue. Eventually, they think overfishing, because there weren't enough local fish to feed the sharks, so they started attacking people. Warmer water temperatures causes more aggressive behavior in sharks, apparently.
Why is that? Do you know?
I couldn't find out why, but I'm going to look into that a little more later. Yeah. And, of course, the sheep carcasses. And then the Egyptian media, unfortunately, aired a racist conspiracy theory.
Whoa.
They found GPS tags on the sharks, and they were saying how it was, like, it was Israeli, like, conspiracy to, like, attack, like, Egyptian tourists.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
That's bad.
And
yeah.
Unfortunately for Sharm el-Sheikh, the tourism industry took an even bigger hit in 2016. Excuse me, 2015. I found out it was largely a Russian tourist area because there was an ISIS terrorist attack on a Metrojet airplane going there that killed 224 people.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, so the tourism industry has been kind of like decimated area because of the shark attacks and the terrorism attacks.
Yeah, it sounds like the plot of some like depressing Russian existentialist novel or something.
Yeah, this right, Connor.
Unfortunate events, man.
Yeah, and I mean, when I looked at the area, I'm like, wow, this is like really gorgeous. And like, yeah. I want to go there almost like one day because it kind of has it all. Like, you know, you have the beaches, you have like the cultural stuff. That, and it's really unfortunate how like these very traumatic, like, very low probability events could just like bring down an entire area.
Right. Yeah.
And that's the story of the 2010 Sharm el-Sheikh shark attacks.
Okay. And if I'm correct, it's very rare to at all be even attacked by a shark. Right?
Yeah.
It's
right.
Lower chances than so many other things happening.
Yeah.
To
I forgot to mention that. Yeah. I think it's like 1 in like 4 million or something.
Yeah. It's a very irrational feel. Like,
yeah.
Way
only
more
like
likely
4 people a year like die. It just so happens that here, because of the oceanic white tip causing the feeding frenzy, that there are multiple sharks willing to attack people.
Right.
Actually, I actually want to get your stance on something, Connor.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
This was briefly mentioned in the oceanic white tip Wikipedia page. So, Dr. Christopher Neff, he's a lecturer in public policy at the University of Sydney. He wrote this paper called The Jaws Effect, How Movie Narratives Are Used to Influence Policy Responses to Shark Bites in Western Australia. And he argues that the word attack has like a cultural stigma behind it, where it's like the sharks are intentionally attacking people, where most of the time it's an accident. So, for example, there'll be like a surfboard, and a surfer will have his arms and legs stretched out, and it looks exactly like a seal.
Right.
And a shark will mistake that surfer for a seal. He didn't mean to attack a person. And there's also other issues where, like, sharks will have, like, neurological damage to their sensory organs, so they can't identify objects as easily.
I've heard their vision isn't very good, right?
I'm not so sure.
Or at least
about
above
that.
Water.
Yeah. Like, they have a very weird sense where they can detect like electromagnetic fields, and that helps them identify certain prey. So what Dr. Christopher Neff argues is that we should use a classification system for, quote, human shark interactions. So we should have encounters, minor bites, moderate bites, and fatal bites. And the purpose of this is to like educate the public on how like we shouldn't intentionally assume we shouldn't assume that sharks are intentionally attacking people,
right?
Because then that causes all these public policies that hurt conservation on oceanic ecosystems.
Yeah.
So it's a bit cumbersome to say, though, versus, you know,
attack. Yeah.
So what's your take on this, Connor?
Well, I'm going to split on this. I have kind of two minds on this. So the first is kind of the more obvious. It's like as someone who like studies linguistics, I can say that like generally the way to approach is that, I mean, if it's colloquial and it works, then don't worry about it too much. I think that like it's gonna be hard to sell to tell people like don't assume that a shark is intentionally attacking you. So I mean, like, you know, it probably is not, but I'm just gonna say that like it's existed in our nomenclature for decades. I mean,
shark attack.
Yeah, realistically, just from a practical standpoint, I don't see the need for that, but I do understand that has implications conservation-wise, and so I would say I'm not against people
using the word shark bite.
Yeah, shark bite works perfectly fine. I mean, it's the idea of like a car accident versus a car crash or collision. So I mean, I'm totally understandable of trying to remove the intent, but my concern is like realistically, like how many people are going to be able to convince to do this? Because like not everyone's going to be too sympathetic to sharks, even if they didn't mean it. So I don't really have an answer for you. I think it's kind of up to individual people to decide on their, by themselves.
From this day forward, I'll always say shark bite instead of shark attack.
I'm sure we could try it. I mean, they probably don't mean it, you know. They just, it's how they go.
All right.
Yeah, so that wraps up shark attacks. Should we go for some off-the-cuff random articles?
Oh, yeah, sure. Why not?
Would you like to go first, or should I?
I'll go first. Let's see. I got Concush Concha. It's Quechua. It's a volcano in Peru that's 15,000 feet tall. It's actually pretty close to the equator. I know there's this other mountain close to the equator in Peru, another volcano, excuse me. And there's like different measurements for how high something is. So, you know, Mount Everest is the tallest in the world, right?
Yeah.
But it's not actually furthest away from the center of the Earth's crust because the Earth bulges out at its equator.
Okay.
So, like, technically, the volcanoes in Peru are a little bit further and higher than the ones in the Himalayas.
Right.
But it's kind of like a semantics issue where it's like, are we measuring from sea level or the center of the Earth's crust? So I always thought it was interesting how in the geosciences they make that distinction.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense.
You found anything cool?
I found tortured artist. I don't know why this is...
Is it like a list or is it describing how they're tortured?
Let me read this. Okay. The tortured artist is a stock character and real-life stereotype who is in constant torment due to frustrations with art and other people. The image that we have here is Vincent Van Gogh's self-portrait with bandaged ear. So as you can see here, I mean, it's the classic picture. I don't know what exactly this is saying. It's just, I think it's just like a general, it's not even like an illness or a particular character. It's just like the idea of the tortured artist. This just sounds like it was written by a 14-year-old. Let me read the characteristics. Tortured artists feel alienated and misunderstood due to the perceived ignorance or neglect of others who do not understand nor support them and the things they feel are important. They sometimes smoke, experience recurring heartbreak, and generally appear overwhelmed by their own emotions and inner conflicts. There are no citations for this article. So this sounds...
It's fake news, man.
Yeah, fake news. It sounds completely written by some 14-year-old.
Yeah, we should discuss that sometime on this show. On this show, we're also trying to educate people on the culture of Wikipedia.
Right, yeah.
So for those of you that don't know, Wikipedia has a very strange editing culture. And there's also a lot of political motivations or corporate motivations to edit certain Wikipedia articles. And a part of being like a Wikipedia volunteer is to like fight back against that or make sure as much information in the article wasn't changed by a nefarious party.
Definitely. And one of the most interesting things I found about Wikipedia is that a lot of people don't know this, but there's a top tab where you can go from article to talk and you can see the editor's
discussion. Yeah.
And so I'm just looking at the talk for tortured artist. It says, boo, delete. The only popular use of tortured artist I can think of is... And then they list something. And something else is like, someone tried to create a list of like popular examples of tortured artists and said, I've removed this list multiple times now for two reasons. The list is completely arbitrary based solely on opinion since only one artist's article actually links to this page and that artist doesn't even appear in the list. The list is already longer than the prose and could grow as large as editors feel like making it. So it's very passive aggressive.
Fights. Also the Wikipedia editing culture is very topic. Personally, I'm not involved. I just know of it.
Yeah, it's just funny to follow along. I mean, you got to be real.
There's a lot of work to go into it too. There's 6 million plus English Wikipedia articles and like who knows how many more in other languages.
Right, and it's all volunteer based.
There's no payment.
There's
the simple English Wikipedia, so like everyone has to duplicate all like the work all over again.
And do you think there's a simple English in other languages?
Or like simple Spanish?
Like simple or simple? I don't know.
I'm not so sure. We have to check that out or get in touch with our French counterparts.
All right. Yeah, that's true. Across the water.
Yeah, across the pond. I found this children's novel called Who... It's not a very long Wikipedia article, but Who is a young adult novel written by Carl Heinsen.
Oh, I read that.
Oh, you read this
middle
book?
Middle school, I did, yeah.
It won a Newbery Medal, so it must be pretty good. The novel is about a boy named Roy Urbanhart and his friends they work to try to save a nest of burrowing owls at a construction site. What was your take on this book, Connor?
Well, I
must have made quite an impression on you, considering that you remember it.
I was about 11 years old, so I do not remember this very well. That was 10 years ago now. But I just remember liking it, man. I mean, it gave me those, you know, those Judy Blume feels, you know, Super Fudge and all that. But it wasn't good enough for me to remember the plot or the characters. You know, I could probably recite a decent amount of the plots of the Fudge books.
Do you remember if the owl was saved or not?
No, but it is a children's book, so I'm going to assume yes. I don't think it's going to end with it tragically.
Tragedy.
And just
no, I don't think so either.
Yeah.
It's a cool cover, though. It's like a flat design. It's like a blue cover with just an owl face on it. Mm-hmm. There's not an actual drawing of an owl.
Right.
And that's that. All
right. You want to keep going, or it's up to you?
I think we're ready to move on to the second topic.
Yeah, so I have another topic that I have prepared that I researched. Specifically, let me get it up here.
I wasn't getting any good hits on the random Wikipedia. Again, for those of you who don't know, for some reason on Wikipedia, if you generate a random article, you either end up with a soccer player, a random insect species, or a naval ship.
Or a town in northern Iran.
Or a town in northern Iran. I don't know why that always happens, but it does.
Or Standard 4.
Or an X-Files episode.
Oh, yeah, X-Files.
Yeah. And that's because every... like soccer player, every biologist who wants to up their publicity will add just a short Wikipedia article. And it turns out when you enumerate all 40,000 or 400,000 insect species out of 6 million Wikipedia articles, it makes up quite a chunk.
And we must have a friend in northern Iran who's just really committed.
Yeah,
I don't know where
these northern Iran village articles, they always end up being like there are 56 families living in this village.
Right.
That's it.
All right, so this next article I have, it's actually kind of related to, you know, we were talking about like environmentalism before with the shark attacks and with this book. So it's called Political Animals and Animal Politics. And it's a 2004 collection of essays that kind of focus on animal ethics.
Is it focusing on like research or veganism and like eating animals?
It's all just philosophy. It's all like humans vis-a-vis animals. And so how we interact with them. And so, yeah, it was published in 2014. And it's basically just, you know, animal ethics, which, yeah, like, you know, human approaches to ethics, but it's gone through, like, political philosophy. So it's more about actual political action as opposed to just the typical moral philosophy, kind of the ideas behind veganism. And
like, how the organizations that handle animals should be structured?
To a degree, but it's a little more about just actual public policy directly, kind of how to approach. I'll go into detail, but so this is kind of, it was written, it's in English, but it was contributors from all different countries. And let's see here. So I had like this one particular one that I read and I thought was pretty fascinating. It's called The Limits of Species Advocacy. And let me see. It's one of the last ones. And basically, let's see. It was written by Curtis Boyer. And so the idea is that...
is there any relation to Boyer who teaches world regions here? It's just coincidence.
Maybe you should ask him.
Yeah.
And so basically what it's about is like the distinction between how non-human animals can receive political protection as individuals as opposed to species. And so what I mean by that is like
Coco the gorilla will get special protections.
Yeah. I mean, that's the idea. And so there's kind of like two sides to it where like, the idea of the it's a little more in the sense that protection of the species is kind of more revolves around like, it's like a human centric desire to have this cute animal still exist. So you can kind of break it up as species, like we find, you know, like penguins at the zoo really adorable and stuff like that. And like, but the idea is that like what you should really do is approach them as individuals. And so what I mean by that and what he means by this is that each individual animal is kind of hypothetically of the same worth kind of as an entity. And a lot of this comes down to is like if there's so like certain ones will have certain advantages or like that will want us to try to protect them. Like, yeah, they're cute or they can be had as pets, you know? But if you have a really ugly animal, like, are you familiar with the blobfish?
No.
Yo, dude, I gotta show you a picture.
Have you ever seen an elephant seal? Oh, I can, you just tell me it's very ugly, I'll assume.
No, you gotta see this, dude. Okay, I'm pulling it up right now. Look up blobfish.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's a good reaction. It is disgusting, but it's an animal. It's a living.
Is it useful?
No. You can't eat it. Maybe it's a bottom feeder, maybe it has some role, but it's not like, it doesn't exactly. We don't work with it as humans, but it's still an animal. You know, it still has its own inherent worth. And what were you going to say?
I wasn't going to say anything.
Okay. Yeah, and so basically what happens with this is that certain animals are prioritized over other ones, And so like a big example of this was the idea of the polar bear. And so the polar bear is kind of like the patron saint of you know, animals that are getting screwed over.
Conservation status? Or need to be protected due to climate change?
Yeah, it's always the example. You have the polar bear, like, isolated on the little iceberg, surrounded by water.
Or is very thin.
Yeah,
I saw that YouTube video, like a month ago.
Yeah, it's always the standard, like, WWF kind of deal.
Right.
And is it not the World Wrestling Federation? Is it the World Wildlife
Fund? It's World Wildlife.
Yeah, they had to make a legal distinction.
It'd be cool if they combined them.
That would be cool if... I don't know what that would entail. It would be people wrestling to raise awareness for the environment. We should organize this. This would be cool. I could see Hulk Hogan, you know, going at it with some, you know, trying to wrestle some dude and raise money. And so basically what happens is that you like certain animals like the polar bear get a lot of attention, but a lot of other animals get, you know, completely ignored. And so I just found that really interesting because like it's the idea of like we don't really think of us as discriminating against animals, but it's really possible species by species, you know.
Yeah, I'm actually involved in a lot of environmental clubs at Virginia Tech, and this kind of ties into a couple topics in the environmental movement. So the first is, how do we value the environment? Some people take a more intrinsic value in the environment, where there's a beauty in seeing certain animals, the beauty of how the ecosystem works together, and that's why we need to protect it. And then there are other people, I feel like I'm more so in this camp, that take on a utilitarian viewpoint where, you know, if we harm the environment, humans and the environment, we're a symbiotic relationship where there's certain resources like wood, lumber, fishing, that are heavily reliant upon sustaining the environment and protecting it. So these two kind of camps kind of like battle out in the environmental movement. And I feel like that's kind of what this paper or book is tackling.
Yeah, and I have a question for you, Chris.
Yeah, sure.
A running theme throughout this book is the idea of how exactly should animals be approached politically, philosophically, morally? Should they be considered on par with humans? Should they be considered below humans? Or should they be considered kind of almost above humans in terms of not priorities, but morally, because they are kind of, they don't even have their own inherent rights because they can't, you know, decide things for themselves in the human context. And so, like, how should they be approached? Should they be considered, like, above all, they're part of the environment and they have to be prioritized, or do they come after us, or are they equal to us? If you know what I mean?
Well, I would, for me personally, it's very much based upon what we value in the animal, or how what the intelligence capability of the animal. I don't really stress out, you know, an insect is an animal. Like,
right.
If I, like, step on it, as kind of ties into our topic last week.
Jainism, yeah.
Yeah. If I harm that animal, like, should it be, like, protected?
Right.
And then also, like I said, I was in the utilitarian camp of the environmental movement, where many of the functions of animals, they're more, I guess, useful as, like, a collective. So an individual fish, it's not very important to protect, but a collection of schools of fish, like a whole fishing stock, that needs to be protected.
And
so that has political value. Now, then you end up in situations where I believe like chimpanzees have the same intelligence as a 4-year-old.
Right.
And there's also situations where we can, in higher level intelligent mammals, also particularly like dogs, we can see like the harm that pain causes them. So I feel like we already have those political protections in place for like specific animals like dogs.
Yeah.
Or do you mean like do I like there's an individual right like per animal, like
that's
almost like a constitutional right?
Yeah, that's basically kind of the crux of this essay and a lot of other ones.
Because I feel like I'm not really like getting that like point.
Yeah, because basically what it's saying is that like we shouldn't view this as such like a human-centric approach, very like a human-based approach, where like we're going to value, you know, cattle because they can work and they can provide food and milk, or we're going to provide like help dogs especially, or you know, anything that can be had as pets, as opposed to the blobfish or something else. The idea is like each individual animal has like its own, as an individual, not just as a species, but like each animal has equal worth. I mean, I guess you can cut a line with insects potentially, but in terms of at least mammals, you know. Do you think that there's a hierarchy for who gets
what gets protection?
Priority, yeah.
I think so, just based upon how animals suffer in different ways. Like a ant doesn't suffer versus how like a fish suffers versus a mammal suffers versus how a human suffers. So I definitely believe there's a hierarchy. And I don't know if politically it's if it's feasible, or B, if it's necessary, or C, what is the value in protecting each of these animals individually?
Right. I mean, I entirely understand what you're saying. Like, I don't have a particularly complex
opinion myself.
I mean, this
is like a totally new viewpoint
to
me, too.
Yeah.
I mean, we only pulled it up based upon a 1 in 6 million chance.
Right. That's
entirely
part of the show. So, like,
I need to read the paper to get a little more background on the topic.
Yeah, I think we'd both, to get to our own kind of opinions, we have to kind of follow it for a bit, you know, that thread. But, I mean, that's the whole
idea.
Did
he provide, like, a particular example where how in individual rights for animals or viewing them as individuals would be useful?
I mean,
that's really what the crux is. Because I can
see
it as more useful to analyze them as a collective, because so much about the environment is how it all, how populations intertwine with each other versus how in like individual animals themselves.
Yeah, I mean, this is so philosophically based. I think the idea is kind of just even removing the human element entirely. So there really aren't specific examples, because it's just the idea that just because you know, you have a dog doesn't mean that it's more valuable than the, you know, coyote wandering the wilderness, or any dog really. So I think that's the general idea, but I mean, it's entirely subjective. There's no answer to this, you know. Yeah. All right.
I think that just about wraps it up.
I think that's pretty much it for Obscurious. Yeah. Any closing thoughts? Do you have anything that you'd like to plug?
Yeah. So at my environmental club, Student for Sustainable Practice, we're having a solar fest at Rising Silo Brewery, 5 to 9 on Tuesday. And if you want to help Virginia Tech help achieve a greener future, please come. There's going to be music and food. And that's just about it.
Nice. Sounds like a good time, man. All right. So, yeah, this has been Obscurious. I've been Connor.
I'm Chris.
And, yeah, hope you have a good one.
Thank you.
secretly fled. Have the boys found the leak yet? Molehill set the wheel in motion. His downfall picks up locomotion. Wife, take a government car in the dark to meet a minister. The leader never leaves a store ajar. Swings the whip from the Boer War. The people must have something good to read on a Sunday. He wore a leather mask for his dinner guest. Totally knew them with deep respect. Proposed a toast to the Bootsy's guest. The feeling of power and the thought of sex. The people must have something. Let the
WUVT, Virginia Tech.